Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two segments today, first in a matter of seconds, we'll hear from Esther Kaplan on the closure of a lighting fixtures plant in Tennessee and what it tells us about standard business strategy. And then we'll hear from Alex Kane of Mondo Weiss, who will explain what Israel is up to in the wake of the kidnapping and death of three teenagers in the West Bank. First, Esther Kaplan. She is editor of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute and author of Losing Sparta in the summer issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review. It's a detailed look at a factory closure in Sparta, Tennessee, a few years ago. Factory closures have become routine news over the last several decades, so much so that the human wreckage that they leave behind has become, sadly, ordinary. Her essay is a moving examination of the human costs of business decisions made by executives far away from the consequences of those decisions. But it also queries the standard business logic behind the move of production from the U.S. to low-wage sites like Mexico and China. Do they make the economic sense in cold business terms that they're said to? Or have they just become a habit, a way of boosting the stock price that does almost no one any good? And what is this productivity god upon whose altar we sacrifice so many a human? You can find Esther Kaplan's essay on the web at vqronline.org, vqronline.org. A personal note, my father spent most of his adult life working for the company that shut the plant, the U.S. branch of the Dutch electronics giant, Philips. When he was working for the company for the 1950s through his retirement in 1981, the company was a paternalistic employer. It has since joined the brutal, profit-maximizing world, as this story illustrates. Esther Kaplan. Tell us about Sparta, Tennessee, the scene of the crime.
Well, Sparta, like Tennessee as a whole, I guess, is a very rural, red area. It's the county seat of White County, which voted overwhelmingly Republican in the last presidential election and is an overwhelmingly white town. I think it's also a place where you can see a lot of the trends in our broader economy playing themselves out in terms of the collapse of decent paying jobs and the collapse of manufacturing.
With a political response which amounts to voting for Mitt Romney, it seems.
Well, I mean, the elected representatives, in not at the very local level, they're concerned about jobs. But if you look at the members of Congress and the senators that Tennessee is sending to Washington, they're either in the Tea Party camp or very influenced by that. There was that very high-profile unionization battle people may remember from some months back at the Volkswagen plant that Senator Corker and others, you know, intervened very aggressively trying to influence that union vote, and eventually it was a hard-fought battle, but they lost it. But there was a lot of very virulent anti-union rhetoric on the part of the elected officials there. And this piece that I write about this plant closing in Sparta, none of those elected officials stepped up to the plate to put pressure on the owner, Phillips, to rethink that decision.
So let's go through the history of the plant. It was a lighting plant about, 50 years old or so?
Yeah, it opened its doors in 1963. It was a lighting fixture plant. They made these big fixtures that you would see like in a Walmart superstore. Walmart was, in fact, a longtime customer of the plant. These big fluorescent fixtures were their stock in trade. The plant opened in the early 60s at a time when a lot of industrial plants were opening there. There'd been a long history of textiles in the area, but industry really picked up in the early 60s. A lot of it was plants coming. This was part of the wave of plants that relocated from the unionized North to the non-unionized South. Tennessee is a right-to-work state, and they found a hardworking workforce who were willing to work for lower wages than in the North. But this actually was a union plant. It was unionized from the start.
How did that come to be? How was it a union plant? Not a place you think of as friendly to union.
It's interesting. It's actually a testament to the power of the trades in their other markets. They were selling to markets in Chicago and New York and Philadelphia, places like that, where the construction trades were unionized and were not necessarily friendly about installing non-union fixtures. So it was initially a family-owned plant, the Thomas family, and they decided for strategic reasons to welcome the union in, because then they could be selling union-made fixtures into these markets.
Yeah, so it's not their love of union so much as their love of selling products.
Exactly.
And so the family ran this plant for decades, right?
It was sold to an intermediary company called Genlight, which was also specifically a lighting company, a small-ish lighting fixture company. And then Genlight was what sold out to Philips just a few years before the closure was announced.
And then what had been going on economically in the area around Sparta the years before Philips came in?
Well, there had started to be a lot of offshoring, so that industrial base that had built up in the 1960s was beginning to empty out, with jobs offshoring to China and Mexico especially. There was one younger worker I spoke to at the plant. This was his third experience of jobs being offshored, you know, by age 32.
And a lot of this was fairly light manufacturing?
Yeah. There were still a lot of textile plants. There were appliance parts, and yeah, there weren't big heavy machines being built in Sparta, but more like machine parts, appliance parts, boat parts, things like that.
Which is, of course, ideal for offshoring.
Right, I guess. Well, that's a question that my piece asked. Did the offshoring in all these cases actually even make business sense or not?
The workers were completely surprised when Philips just came in one day and shut the plant, right?
Well, this is what happened in the lead up to this announcement. The shutdown was announced in the fall of 2010, and the plant didn't close until a year and a half later. In the months leading up to that announcement, the plant had been named by Industry Week as one of the most productive plants in all of America. It had won within Philips what they call the Lean Manufacturing Challenge. So it was considered globally within Philips the preeminent example of lean manufacturing practices. So they kept having these ceremonies and having trophies and banners and celebrations at the plant because they were a model for automated manufacturing, for quick turnaround. I mean, they could get an order in and get it out the door and get paid on their invoices before they were even paying for the steel that they brought in to make the fixtures out of. So it was a really impressively run operation, and it was being acknowledged as such on a regular basis. So their jaws were on the floor. I mean, people couldn't believe it.
Who was responsible for this lean, efficient, productive operation? Was it local management, the workers?
Yeah, well, I would actually say this is one of those examples where the local management and the union were working together hand in hand. The union was really focused on maintaining jobs. So when management wanted to bring in an automated line, they actually had contract protections against automation, and they agreed to negotiate that away in return for bringing in that line and bringing in more jobs. So the union and management were consistently working together. There was also, I think, a real spirit among this particular management team of really bringing the workers in on the decision making. So they would collectively come up with ways to speed up production. The workforce was extremely stable and had a very strong esprit de corps. So people would be literally taking bits of piecework home at night so that in the morning the production lines could zoom into motion without any delay. There was really a sense of everyone being on board trying to make things as efficient as possible. And some of the lines also had incentive pay. So the workers were incentivized. If they could beat production targets, then they could increase their pay by 20, 30, 40%.
So this was not your caricature of overpaid union workers lazing about?
Hardly.
And so what was the response when Philips announced their plans to close the place?
The union, the IBEW local, a really impressive local, they rallied. They organized petition drives. They organized marches. They met with all the local public officials, the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, it was really interesting how these camps that you think of as being so divided in this country, in this case, joined hands. The local business leaders are the elected officials in Sparta. They're one and the same, and they all joined together to try to convince Phillips to change their minds, and called, and they got the county official, the mayor, everyone on the phone with the top executives at Phillips North America and tried to get them to reconsider this. When that went nowhere, there was actually even a plan that was hatched by the management team at the plant to buy out the plant. And they got local banks to back them and local officials to agree to put up a bond measure to the tune of, I mean, they had no equity. They just had this business plan which said, we can make these fixtures cheaper than Phillips can make them in Mexico. And they persuaded all these banks and the Tennessee Valley Authority and everybody. They raised, I think, commitments of $14 or $15 million to try to buy out the plant. And Phillips still said, no, thank you.
If Phillips just didn't want to sell them the plant.
The notes that I got about the process were they had one meeting about it.
So they just made up their minds and closed their ears and didn't want to hear or talk.
Pretty much.
But they had managed to persuade some bankers and local officials that they had a credible business plan. This was not pie-in-the-sky stuff.
Yeah, and I looked at the business plan. It was very persuasive, and clearly it persuaded three different state agencies and a bank and local local state and county officials to fork over millions of dollars to back it. So, and those were all places that did serious due diligence on the plan. So looked to me like it was a pretty good one. But Phillips didn't spend the amount of time reviewing the plan that these local bankers did.
It's amazing, you know, the dodgy stuff that gets financed these days, but apparently really solid stuff like this can't get off the ground. So what happened? The plant then moved to Mexico. How did things work out in Mexico?
Well, a handful of the jobs, I will say, at Phillips' insistence, did go to Tupelo, Mississippi, but the bulk of the production was moved to Mexico. These mammoth machines, Doug, you've probably been in plants like this, were dug out of the ground. They were anchored maybe 20 feet into the ground, were dug out of the ground, broken apart, put on semis, and shipped down to Mexico and reinstalled. It was a massive, massive operation that cost in and of itself millions of dollars. And then they ended up setting up a plant, going from an extremely experienced workforce to a totally inexperienced workforce. And then we're stuck with the situation of having to transport these fixtures over not very well maintained roads through Mexico and across the border. And I have word from people inside the lighting division at Phillips that they lost huge amounts of market share over this. The plant before had been able to do extraordinarily fast turnaround time. Now orders were taking 6 to 8 weeks as opposed to a handful of days for delivery. So they just hemorrhaged customers.
Yeah, because the Tennessee location, which is in about a day's drive of half the U.S. population or something like that, right? And then they move far away and can't meet short turnaround times, and the infrastructure in Mexico not so good either.
More breakage, so a lot more loss. The product loss that coming out of Spargo was, you know, 1 or 2% or something, and that skyrocketed. And they had a lot of, once you have that slow turnaround time, you have all these warehousing costs where you have to just be shipping stuff and storing it in distribution centers in order to somehow still reach your clients in time. So you have just the logistics costs kind of went through the roof.
So in other words, the hope for increased profits by moving out of a high wage area to a low wage area, the profits didn't materialize.
That's my understanding, and Phillips did not try to claim otherwise. And if you look at the profits within their lighting division, they plummeted. I mean, for other reasons as well, but they plummeted after the move. Phillips offered me no evidence, and my sources tell me otherwise, that there was any profit increase by making this move.
I'm speaking with Esther Kaplan, editor of the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund and author of Losing Sparta in the summer issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review. Well, which takes us to the larger questions around this. Offshoring has become gospel in American business over the last 30 years or so. But how many stories like this are there where allegedly high-cost plant production is moved to low-cost areas and the profits don't materialize? Do we know just how successful these moves are from the point of view of management or stockholders?
Okay, so here is the dirty secret that I discovered reporting this piece. We do not know. Shareholders of corporations do not know. the SEC does not require corporations to reveal even to report even one sentence about why they make an offshoring decision. The Department of Commerce, Department of Labor, no one requires corporations to say why they moved and whether the moves were profitable. Even companies that receive millions of dollars in public subsidies from the federal government are not required to disclose why they move hundreds or even thousands of jobs out of this country. And shareholders aren't even told about the size of the U.S. workforce. Corporations are allowed to fudge these numbers and just report global workforce. So as a shareholder of a company or a member of the public, you can't even know whether the U.S. workforce has been slashed in half in the last year. The disclosure is pitiful. And I found studies like one from Michael Porter, who's a celebrated economist at Harvard, published in the Harvard Business Review, showing that offshoring decisions have the least due diligence of any major corporate strategic decision that's made.
Yeah, now Michael Porter, of course, is a major guru in the business world. And so, I mean, he's not just some guy sounding off on Twitter. But like, there's just no one really knows, even according to Michael Porter.
Yeah, well, he talked to hundreds and hundreds of graduates of the Harvard Business School who've been involved in relocation decisions in recent years. So this is very, like, rubber meets the road kind of research. And this is what he found, that there's almost no due diligence, that people, companies, make offshoring decisions in a very knee-jerk way. They're presuming. I mean, we kind of fetishize corporations and think that they're making all of these careful market-based decisions, but actually a lot of it is really knee-jerk stuff. It's not thought through, and the diligence hasn't been done. This particular case in Sparta, I saw it. I saw no evidence that Philips had sent in people to try to do a granular analysis of operations and really figure out that they could do better down in Mexico.
They just automatically assume that. But it's also been the case over the last 30 years that stockholders sort of have a knee-jerk reaction when a plant closure is announced. You buy the stock. I mean, it's very Wall Street flattering.
Right. So maybe on that level, in terms of stock price, maybe there's some logic behind it. But in terms of operations and actual profit, revenue generation, it's not clear that this is the right move. And in fact, there's in the last couple of years, there are increasingly studies out of influential places like McKinsey about nearshoring, that actually there are a lot of strategic advantages to doing your production close to where your market is.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the business doctrine of the 80s, too. You want to be close to your markets and be really flexible. I mean, apparently, moving to Mexico or China took precedence over that idea. But, you know, it's related. It's funny. Like, there's also no evidence that mergers work very well. And there's like 100 years of evidence that mergers don't work very well, yet companies keep merging over and over again.
Yeah, well, this is the thing I think we don't understand, certainly in this country, is how many of these big corporate decisions seem to be based on ideology or kind of trends in thinking and not based on due diligence. We give corporations way more credit than they deserve on a lot of these big strategic decisions that have enormous effect on the U.S. economy.
Now, of course, this is all done in the name of productivity, which is our great God. What has been the payoff for productivity increases for the American worker over the last couple of decades?
Well, this is actually sort of what got me started on this piece, was meditating on all of this. Everyone celebrates productivity. Are the economists in this country who have the biggest megaphones, the most prominent elected officials, we all celebrate American productivity, which zooms up, you know, even in times of recession. And it's supposed to be creating higher standards of living. It's supposed to be creating jobs. It's supposed to be doing, you know, every good thing, including, you know, bacon, apple pie. And yet what I'm finding is there's more and more of a disconnect. That, I mean, this is, you know, groups like the Economic Policy Institute have been noticing this for close to, you know, 15 to 20 years now, which is that there's increasingly no correlation between rising productivity and rising wages. And there's also very little correlation between rising productivity and job creation. So what we're looking at is workers working harder and harder and longer for less pay, fewer benefits. And there's one set of beneficiaries, and that's shareholders. But it's not clear that for the economy as a whole, for working people, that there is a benefit. There's a cost to American workers, to their family lives, to their health, but it's not clear that there's an upside.
And what's left behind in Sparta now?
Well, I talked to a lot of the former plant workers about what's going on for them and elected officials and business leaders about what's going on in the community. I mean, it's been bad. Unemployment rose. It hasn't rebounded. The tax base has shrunk. It's not good in the community. In terms of the individual workers, I mean, they went from, and this is the kind of data that the National Employment Law Project has been pumping out since the recovery, such as it is, took hold, which is that middle-income jobs are being replaced by low-income jobs. And this is what I found there. People who were earning $13, $14, $15, $16 an hour with vacation pay and health benefits, good health benefits, retirement plans, are now working $8 an hour as nursing assistants or are working manufacturing jobs but through a temp agency where they only get $8, $9, $10 an hour with no benefits, no guarantee that they have a job from week to week, no retirement, no, not even a paid sick day. So people's conditions have really gotten bad. I mean, everyone is living very close to the bone and, you know, they've emptied out the severance pay that the union negotiated. They've run out of their extended unemployment. They're in trouble.
How did the people you talked to understood what happened to them? Did they have any kind of analysis?
It's interesting. They really talked a lot. And again, this is a very Republican country, about corporate greed. And I include members of the local Chamber of Commerce here. I mean, the mayor, who's on the Chamber of Commerce, his mom worked at the plant from the month it opened. He grew up running around in that plant, and he's now a small business owner. He owns an auto collision shop. And he just said, I can't imagine shutting my shop and moving it a few towns over just to make a few more bucks. Like, they were shocked by this lack of business ethics, I guess you would say. It was upsetting to them and disturbing to them.
Here we are in Tennessee, a state that is doing all the things that a neoliberal state is supposed to do. That's, you know, this was a union plant in particular, but you know, they're resolutely anti-union, low cost, low benefit, extremely flexible, as they like to say, workforce. And what do they have to show for it?
Oh, well, and let's talk about the public subsidies. I mean, Phillips was already enjoying cut rate power from the Tennessee Valley Authority. It was enjoying huge tax breaks from the city and the county. I mean, they emptied out their pockets to keep this plant there, and it didn't work. And I think it's, I mean, honestly, I think it was a huge psychological blow to everyone in that town.
Are they optimistic about recovery now? Is there any, does anyone in Sparta have a plan for turning things around?
The plan seems to be that maybe companies will start coming back in now that they know they can get a desperate low-wage workforce, which is a kind of depressing sort of optimism.
So this is what the meaning behind the trendy onshoring or reshoring or nearshoring or all these terms that the consultants come up with.
Well, it's like as wages start rising in China and as people get more economically desperate here and are willing to take 25, 30, 40% less pay than they used to make, then it becomes a little more economically viable to bet on desperate American workers.
That was Esther Kaplan, editor of the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund and author of Losing Sparta in a summer issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review. You can find her essay on the web at vqronline.org, vqronline.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. That was some of Need Electric by Daniel Avery. Next up, Alex Kane. Kane is an assistant editor at MondoWeiss.net and world editor for Alternet. Here he is to explain just what Israel is up to in the occupied territories following the kidnapping and murder of three settler teens in the West Bank several weeks ago. Just to orient you in time and space, this interview was recorded on Wednesday morning, July 2nd, and references to yesterday and today should be processed with that in mind. Alex Kane. What's going on in Gaza now? What is Israel doing at the moment?
Well, in Gaza at this very moment seems quiet, although this might escalate. 2 days ago, on Monday, after the bodies of three Israeli teens were found killed in the occupied West Bank, Israel heavily bombed Gaza over 30 times because they say that Hamas, which governs Gaza, is responsible for the teens' killings, although we don't have any concrete evidence that points to the Hamas leadership as a whole directly tying themselves to the abduction and the killings. News reports have indicated that a sort of rogue sort of unit of two men loosely affiliated with Hamas, but sort of part, at least one of them part of a clan that has undercut Hamas's attempts to reach a ceasefire with Israel, that they are the ones responsible. So the bombing of Gaza was in response to rocket fire from Gaza into Israel, which of course is in response to an Israeli blockade and also to the teens' abduction and the claims that Hamas is responsible.
Now, just on the face of it, makes no sense that Hamas would do this, knowing precisely what sort of reaction it would evoke. Has Israel offered any evidence for this proposition?
No, you're totally right. And they have offered no evidence, even though Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that he will publish evidence in the coming days that will directly link Hamas to the abduction. But you're totally right. It doesn't make any sense. Hamas, last month, or the end of April, I believe, signed a reconciliation agreement with Fatah, the more secular Palestinian nationalist party that rules the West Bank, and they're the most sort of powerful player in the Palestinian Authority and the Palestine Liberation Organization. They signed this reconciliation agreement because they're weak. Hamas is in a really precarious position. Their ally in Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, was overthrown by a brutal Egyptian military regime, which has continued to crack down on smuggling tunnels into Gaza, which sprouted up because of the Israeli blockade. And that's one way that people in Gaza got goods. And of course, militant groups in Gaza use those tunnels for weapons. Now, the economic situation turned from bad to worse when the military regime came to power in Egypt. My point is that Hamas is in an extremely weak position. And so this is one reason that pushed them to sign this reconciliation agreement that was quite favorable to Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority and Fatah. And so the claims that Hamas would jeopardize their reconciliation agreement, their attempts at getting on a firmer footing through this reconciliation agreement by killing Israeli teens doesn't make any sense.
Can you talk a bit more about the Egyptian angle? What is the current government's interest in the current situation?
Of course, for decades, since the 1979 peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, Egypt has been removed from the Arab state equation when it comes to challenging Israel. Of course, the Arab states have never been successful in challenging Israel, and in many instances, particularly Jordan, have had agreements with Israel and have collaborated with them. But, you know, Egypt did wage wars against Israel, and they were Israel's most formidable military foe in the Middle East until, that is, 1979, when Egypt moved firmly into the U.S. and Western orbit, began undertaking economic policies that are neoliberal in character, and really began becoming a key U.S. ally in the Middle East. Basically, you know, they received the second most amount in military aid after Israel from the U.S. And so when Hosni Mubarak was overthrown, there was a lot of trepidation among Israelis that this might be the beginning of the end of their peace treaty with Egypt, and that Egypt may emerge over the next couple of years as a defender of Palestinians. That did not really happen. The election of Mohamed Morsi did give Hamas a boost, but you know, Morsi was in a very tenuous position, and he couldn't make any moves that really challenged Israel. Nonetheless, you know, Morsi was overthrown, and now we have Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in power after the military coup last year. And Sisi has, of course, is another big-time U.S. ally, as well as a big ally of the Gulf Arab states. So his interest in terms of the Israel-Palestine question is, A, to maintain the strong relationship with Israel. I don't think that's going away anytime soon with Sisi in power. And also, you know, Sisi and his regime see political Islam as an existential threat to them, to the military regime and the military's interests in Egypt, which also include, you know, economic interests. They have a lot of money invested in the Egyptian economy. And so they see, and Hamas is affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. They're kind of the Palestinian national offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so it's become part of this conflict between political Islamic groups within Egypt and the regime, and Hamas has been really damaged by that conflict.
And of course, we know we saw the U.S. Making some disapproving noises about the brutal human rights violation of Sisi's government, but they're still writing the checks. So it must be that the U.S. is rather pleased with these developments.
Absolutely. I mean, there were noises when the coup occurred and when there were large-scale killings of hundreds of unarmed Muslim Brotherhood protesters. Of course, actions mean much louder than words. Obama temporarily suspended a slight portion of the military aid the U.S. gives, but, you know, John Kerry was there visiting Sisi 2 weeks ago, and he said, you know, the Apaches are coming, and he's confident that the military aid will continue to flow in full to this military regime.
And now returning to Israel's behavior during this, it's now being reported in some circles that the Israeli government knew for days, perhaps weeks, that the kidnapped teenagers were dead and kept mum about that. What do you think of that, and if so, why?
Absolutely. I think the people who have been saying this, and myself included, are right. The Israeli authorities and the Israeli media who are operating under a gag order. This is important in the story. You know, Israel has a draconian military censor that frequently imposes gag orders on local media and prevents them from reporting many details of the investigation that the reporters have found out about. So basically, the media and the Israeli government conveyed this assumption that the teens were alive. In fact, Moshe Ya'alon, the defense minister, said that we're working on the assumption that the teens are alive. This is what he said publicly. In fact, the day the teens were abducted, the police in a West Bank settlement got a phone call from one of the teens who said, "We've been kidnapped." The police officer said, the police dispatcher on the phone said, you know, he didn't know what to do. He I don't think he took it seriously. If you listen to the recording, he keeps on saying, "Hello, hello," while the teenager says, "We've been kidnapped." And then you hear gunshots on this phone call that the Israeli police had the day of the kidnappings. So, you know, at the very least, they knew that the teens were harmed. And then we've seen reports that quoted sort of anonymous Israeli sources as saying that, you know, we were operating under the assumption that we were looking for bodies, not alive teens. And, you know, so they kept this from the public. I think the reason why they kept it from the public is that it allowed them to exploit this uncertainty and wreak havoc on the West Bank and Hamas in the West Bank, although it's not just limited to Hamas, to try to find these teens, although they probably knew they were dead.
They made a great show of searching for the teens. What exactly did that mean on the ground?
They did make a great show. I mean, you know, the teens were abducted in the Gush Etzion settlement block, which is sort of south, in the south of the West Bank, near Hebron. And so they started their operation near there. They were looking all over Hebron. They basically put the city under closure, you know, collectively punishing all Palestinians in Hebron and in the surrounding villages of Hebron. Beit Omar and other villages. Then they, you know, when they didn't find bodies, they turned to raiding basically every city in the West Bank, including Ramallah, which is it's not far from Hebron, but it's not close. It's, you know, kind of depending on the checkpoints that are in place at the moment, it takes maybe an hour and a half or a bit longer to get from Ramallah to Hebron. And so, you know, the notion that the teens were hiding in downtown Ramallah or in the north in Jenin or in any of the cities they raided was ridiculous. Yet they raided all these cities, and these raids are not, you know, these are not just anodyne raids. You know, they include Israeli soldiers, you know, ransacking, rampaging through Palestinian homes, you know, overturning kitchens, sequestering Palestinians, including young children in one room while the soldiers, you know, basically mess up their homes.
Now was this indiscriminate, or were they targeted harassments?
It was pretty indiscriminate. It was pretty indiscriminate. I mean, many of the people targeted were affiliated with Hamas. Of course, sort of political allegiances are quite fluid, but, you know, Israel claimed that they were targeting Hamas. To back up my claim that it's indiscriminate, I mean, Israel turns Hamas into this monster devil organization. They're only interested in death and killing, and this is a quite simplistic view of Hamas. You know, they're a political movement with deep roots in Palestinian society, and, you know, they do charities, they have mosques, they have et cetera, you know, all this stuff. And so, you know, they were targeting Hamas members that had nothing to do with the kidnapping. And so this was indiscriminate. And they also targeted, you know, Palestinian media stations, Palestinian schools. These places, they were not holding the three Israeli youth and had nothing to do with Hamas's militant activities. There's a political wing of Hamas, a social wing of Hamas, and a military wing of Hamas.
And then how do you read Israel's intentions? Were they just trying to spread terror among the population? Did they have some specific goal in mind? What was behind this campaign of harassment over the last several weeks?
I think the main goal was to exploit the opportunity to strike a further blow at Hamas, which is their most effective political adversary, you know, and of course to spread havoc among the West Bank population and to collectively punish Palestinians. But I think the main political goal was to further strike a blow at Hamas. And you know, this, and it was also, I think, to undermine the unity agreement that Hamas had signed with Fatah. You know, the background to this is that Fatah, the more secular movement backed by the West and Hamas, had been split bitterly over the past, since 2006. And this was the result, you know, Hamas won democratic elections in Palestine, and at sort of the urging of the U.S., Israel allowed Palestinians to hold elections in the West Bank and Gaza, and lo and behold, Hamas won. And then the international community, you know, the U.S. and Israel and the West did not accept the results, and they basically tried to help Fatah to control all the West Bank and Gaza. What happened is that an attempted coup backed by the U.S., particularly Elliot Abrams, the neoconservative official in the Bush administration, backfired. Hamas wrested control of Gaza from Fatah, killed Fatah militants, and then this was the split between Fatah, who rules the West Bank, and Hamas in Gaza. And so 6 or 7 years later, for a variety of reasons, Hamas and Fatah signed an agreement that threatened Israel with the prospect of a united Palestinian front. I should say that there were many problems with this unity agreement, and not at all clear it was going to work, but I think Israel was quite displeased at this.
I'm speaking with Alex Kane, an assistant editor at MondoWeiss.net and world editor for Alternet. And does Gaza have anything resembling a functioning government?
They do. They do. It's not chaos in Gaza. Hamas has quite a tight grip on the sort of governing institutions and populace there. You know, there have been rumblings of dissent against Hamas's, frankly, authoritarian rule. But they have a quite tight grip on Gaza, and I don't think they're going anywhere anytime soon. And so, yeah, it's absolutely functioning. And, you know, I think the clearest way you can see Hamas's control in Gaza is the fact that they act as the kind of sole law enforcement and military power in Gaza, meaning that they've tried with mostly success to prevent other Palestinian militant factions from firing rockets into Israel. So many of the rockets over the past year since the ceasefire in 2012, after Israel launched a military operation and they reached a ceasefire maybe 8 days later, there was a ceasefire and Hamas tried to prevent, at least not 100% success, but mostly they were mostly successful in preventing Palestinian factions from escalating the conflict. And so, you know, Hamas has security control, economic control, political control in Gaza.
To listen to some Israelis and their partisans in the U.S. Talk, it sounds as if Israel is under a constant carpet bombing attack by these rockets being launched out of Gaza. What is the truth of these rockets attacks?
The vast majority of them, for a very long time, were quite crude. They're not targeted. The rockets often fall in empty fields in Israel. And I think it's important to know that many of the militants are firing rockets at villages that were ethnically cleansed of Palestinians in 1948. It's just an important side note to this whole thing. Now, this is not to say that the rockets cannot kill. They have killed. They have injured in the past. During the 2012 conflict, you saw Hamas had more sophisticated rockets than they had before, called the Fajr rockets, which reached Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. They didn't. They're not sort of guided missiles, anything like that. But they were more powerful than what Hamas had in the past. So the claims that Israel is under existential threat from Hamas rockets is wildly overblown. And of course, the root cause of why these rockets are being fired is, well, I mean, the larger kind of scope of this is the conflict and the frustration and killings of Palestinians in Gaza, but also, you know, the blockade that Israel imposed in 2007.
And Israel domestically has been whipped into what looks like a frenzy of bloodlust over this kidnapping, hasn't it?
They have. I mean, today we got news that a 16-year-old Palestinian teenager in Jerusalem from the Shu'afat refugee camp was murdered. Looks like by extremist Israelis. Unclear who exactly murdered him, but that much is clear, that he was murdered by Israelis in a revenge attack related to Israeli anger over the killings of the three Israeli youths earlier this week. And so the situation is escalating. And also yesterday, there were reportedly more kidnap attempts of Palestinians, and there were mobs of young Israeli Jews marching through Jerusalem, chanting death to Arabs, and, you know, even walking into a McDonald's looking for Arab workers. You know, there are videos of this circulating online of Israelis in Jerusalem chanting death to Arabs. And you have Netanyahu today condemning the murder of the Palestinian team as despicable. Yet this is the same Netanyahu who yesterday called Hamas the devil and said that the Palestinians who murdered the Israeli youth were human animals. They were beasts. Now, this is classic demonization of Palestinians and dehumanization. Yes, he said that the specific Palestinians behind these killings were not human, but for Israeli society, I don't think they see much of a difference between any Palestinian. You see calls to destroy Fatah and Hamas after this, which doesn't make much sense rationally from a political point of view, but this is the kind of bloodlust that Israel has been whipped into by their leadership and by more extreme right-wing figures in the Israeli political landscape. It is quite a scary situation.
Yes, that's there are some right-wing politicians for whom Netanyahu is not ghoulish enough, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's quite interesting. You know, I recently returned from a reporting trip to Israel and the West Bank in May, and I, you know, speaking to some settlers, it's very clear that they don't think Netanyahu and the military do enough to protect them, which is sort of astounding when you first hear it. You know, this is the same state that provides funding and, you know, the military basically to protect the settlers, but they are not pleased with the Israeli government because they're not extreme rightists. They are quite right wing, but in the Israeli political landscape, they're not the farthest right.
Where does this go? If for the most vocal forces in Israel, Netanyahu is not aggressive enough, where is this leading? What is the logical outcome of this approach to the Palestinian population?
it's always a fool's errand trying to make predictions, but I think, to be quite honest, I mean, this situation could escalate. I don't think Israel wants it to escalate, though. I think it wants to continue to exact some measure of vengeance in response to the killings of the Israeli youth, but they're walking a really thin line because they don't want to disrupt the status quo so much that it leads to large-scale protests or violence. And, you know, this is a very fine line. It's very hard to see what exactly is going to happen in these situations, because when you have this pressure cooker of violence and racism, it's tough to predict. But what I would say is that, you know, there's going to be some more responses, and they're going to attempt to find the people who they say killed the Israeli youth. Beyond that, I would guess that the military operations will continue but will be scaled back. I mean, today it seems things are quite on fire, particularly in Jerusalem. There were clashes between Palestinians angry about the murder of the 16-year-old and Israeli soldiers. But I don't think Israel has an interest in escalating it to a point where it gets out of control.
And any word from Washington? What are they telling the Israelis?
When the youths were abducted, you know, John Kerry said, we also think it was Hamas, and he didn't present any evidence, and that the State Department repeated that this week, even though there's really no evidence. And in terms of the response, President Obama, John Kerry, Samantha Power, Ambassador Susan Rice, not former UN Ambassador Susan Rice, current National Security Council member Susan Rice, they all said, you know, as a father, as a mother, you know, we empathize with the Israeli families whose sons were killed. And of course, in the context of a political conflict that the U.S. is deeply invested in, this makes sense to condemn the war crime that Palestinian militants reportedly carried out in Hebron. At the same time, they were totally silent on the six Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers over the past 2 weeks in while they were allegedly searching for these teens. No response on the arrest and sort of ransacking of homes, nothing. So that really gives you a window into the U.S.-Israel relationship. Immediate condemnations of any violence carried out by the population that is under brutal occupation, and total silence when it comes to Israeli soldiers killing Palestinians. Today, there was some tweets from Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., saying that the U.S. condemns the murder of the 16-year-old Palestinian teenager, but this is quite pro forma, and this was also a vigilante attack. You know, maybe they're more comfortable condemning the most extreme elements of Israeli society, while the military, for them, they're just doing their job. And this is, of course, framed in security terms. They're protecting Israel, and they, you know, this and so on. And Netanyahu also did this. He said, when Mahmoud Abbas said, you know, we've condemned the abduction, but where's Netanyahu to condemn the deaths of Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers? And Netanyahu said, you know, of course any loss is tragic, but the Israeli soldiers were defending themselves, and so on.
And then finally, what's your evaluation of the American media's coverage of this affair?
Not good, not good at all, which is not a surprise. The whole frame of this has been, you know, I mean, many of the American media has largely taken the Israeli line that this was Hamas, sort of hook, line, and sinker. This was the kind of frame that many media outlets allowed their interviewees to propagate, and also themselves, they kind of frame this around Hamas, even though we don't have much evidence. And you know, when the teens were killed, CNN had on four or five Israeli officials or former officials to weigh in, and no Palestinians. Maybe this will get better in the coming days. But you know, overall, I think it's been framed as, you know, these three teens were abducted and killed for no reason, and that Israel is responding in a proportionate way, and that it was Hamas that did it, even though we have, again, no evidence that it was the leadership of Hamas that directed this kidnapping and killing.
That was Alex Kane, an assistant editor at MondoWeiss.net and world editor for Alternet. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Alfred Schnittke's trio for violin, cello, and piano, performed by Ole Krisa, Torleif Teden, and Tatiana Cecchino. Till next week, bye.